Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, shortly after we recorded yesterday's podcast, we saw the news that broke. I saw it first over Twitter. Other people probably saw it somewhere else first. That Richard Engel, the longtime lead Middle East foreign affairs correspondent, I don't know his exact title for NBC News, had been missing for a number of days, believed to be inside Syria. And given the civil war there and the elements that are involved on both sides of that civil war, the odds weren't necessarily looking that great. But we got fantastic news this morning. Richard Engel and his crew have been freed. It was not without a few harrowing moments, to say the least, though. Here's just a little bit of what Engel described for NBC's Today show this morning.
They kept us blindfolded, bound. We weren't physically beaten or tortured. It was a lot of psychological torture, threats of being killed. They made us choose which one of us would be shot first. And when we refused, there were mock shootings. They pretended to shoot Ghazi several times. And when you're blindfolded and then they fire the gun up in the air, it can be very a traumatic experience.
Ultimately, they were rescued when they tried to take Engel and his team to another safe house, but they came across a rebel checkpoint. There, a gunfight ensued, and at that point, they were freed. They're now in Turkey. And, Jim, we complain a lot of times for very good reason about the quality of our media. Engel is one of the better ones, certainly at NBC. And those who conduct reporting in these types of situations deserve a lot of respect. And we're just grateful and very glad to see them well and getting through this harrowing situation.
It is fantastic news, and I think it kind of says something that it takes something like Richard Engel being abducted and being able to escape a very dangerous situation to get Syria back into the news. It kind of seems that this has been this rather horrific civil war, estimates of 40,000 dead over the past year, maybe you might even say 2 years. And we talk about it periodically, and then it kind of fades away, and then they'll mention something like the possible use of chemical weapons, and then it'll fade away. It must be very, Richard Engel takes an enormous risk, and every foreign correspondent, every war zone takes extraordinary risks to go out and get the story. It kind of bugs me that what they do isn't considered a bigger deal, even when they're not, dodging abductions and stuff like that. I feel like, we don't pay enough attention to foreign news in this country. I understand the instinctive mentality of, oh, it's far away, and how does it affect me and stuff like that, but one, it can come back to affect us in many ways, and I feel like even if it's not that, I think, something as horrific as a bloody civil war in Syria should not disappear from the headlines for weeks at a time. And so thank goodness Richard Engel is okay, and looking forward to his reporting from the Middle East region for, a long time to come.
On to a martini number two now, and this goes back to the gun debate that's obviously engulfed the political world and really the whole nation over the past few days, ever since the horrific shootings at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. And now what we're seeing, Jim, is a number of red state, more conservative-leaning Democrats, or at least they describe themselves that way, kind of leading the charge away from their previous positions. A couple of them, even before they take their oaths, like Joe Donnelly of Indiana and Joe Manchin, who was reelected to finally his own full term in West Virginia. NRA guys, decent ratings from the NRA. They're not necessarily saying, though, what they're willing to do. They want everybody to sit down at the table. So I think a lot of times that's, some people say, a code word for giving into gun control measures that might not necessarily do anything. Other people just want to have all the ideas expressed out there. So not a lot specific has been said yet, but it's interesting that some have even used a shotgun in TV ads, like Joe Manchin is now scurrying to make sure he's on the politically correct side of this debate.
Yeah, and there's two ways to look at this. One is the possibility that this is a fig leaf. This is a bunch of Democrats who now find themselves under extraordinary pressure and are afraid of being the villain, cast as the villain in the debate that we are going to see in the coming weeks and months. And so this is them indicating that they're supporting some non-specified limitations of the Second Amendment. And then by the time it's actually put down on legislation, it may or may not be something they vote for. But I think it says it was back to something. And I've had disagreements with my good friends at the NRA over this a couple times. Back in, back when every Democrat on Capitol Hill was voting for Obamacare, or I guess I should say just enough of them were voting for Obamacare to ensure its passage, I had a rather impassioned rant that there's really no such thing as a conservative Democrat, that It's up there with the Tooth Fairy, et cetera, because they always fold when you need, you know, always enough of them fold as, you know, for Nancy Pelosi to get what she wants. And this is all very well organized. They know that they need, you know, 218 votes. And if they have 225 members, that means six folks can vote against the party as a whole. And they allocate those. And in the end, Nancy Pelosi always gets what she wants. And I think if you really are a conservative Democrat, then I can't understand how you would vote for Nancy Pelosi to be Speaker of the House in the first place. And in the case of Manchin and Joe Donnelly and a couple of these other guys, look, I mean, you're going to have a more conservative Senate if you vote for Mitch McConnell than if you vote for Harry Reid. That's just the way it is. And we see these guys, you know, already making noises about it. Look, what are you going to do, Indiana? You already voted for the guy. There you go. I guess Richard Murdoch really was that unacceptable. I hope every gun owner in Indiana looks at that vote and then realizes, geez, you know, look what I got in result of that. As you pointed out, Joe Manchin, you know, depicted himself shooting, was it Obamacare or the EPA regulation?
Cap and trade,
okay. Shooting cap and trade with a gun in his ad. By the way, after Tucson, nobody seemed to blame him for promoting guns and violence right. And stuff. My instinct is that, look at the way this debate is going and how much of it is, you know, white suburbanites who live in office complexes with armed security guards. Talking about the you know, bitter clingers clinging to their guns and religion, then whatever legislation comes out of this, it's going to be overreaching, and it's going to be something that no NRA-endorsed or Republican or Democrat who considers himself to be pro-Second Amendment could possibly support, which is, you know, good, because I'd rather have this go down in flames than to have a bad idea pass out of a, you know, sense of panic or something. My guess is, we're going to see these guys slip back because I think they realize the consequences of voting in favor of some pro-gun control legislation and how that would, you know, kind of wreck their images.
The problem here, of course, is that the knee-jerk instinct is, well, we have to do something. And even if that something doesn't necessarily really address the problem, well, at least we did something. And then the second bad instinct a lot of times is that something has to be done by the federal government. And so those two instincts often combine for not good results. And we've seen it in a lot of different areas, not only in the wake of tragedy. So tread lightly, Congress and everybody else in Washington. On to Martini number three now. Jim, and, you know, it's just a couple of weeks ago when Jim DeMint announced his resignation, and we were kind of shell-shocked by that. You very methodically went through the possible replacements for his seat, including the man who ultimately was announced as his successor, Congressman Tim Scott, yesterday. And I jokingly said, well, what about Governor Appalachian Trail? And we're like, no, maybe his wife, but not him. Well, it turns out Mark Sanford is now exploring the possibility of running for Tim Scott's soon-to-be-vacant House seat. The former governor is also a former member of Congress. Jim, I don't know about you, but something tells me this is not only too soon, but it's very much too soon, because never would be too soon, I think, for most people in South Carolina.
You know, I'm going to give you a slight correction to that, Greg. Okay. And this is not me endorsing Mark Sanford, just observing that people in South Carolina were very upset about his behavior on his, you know, hiking the Appalachian Trail and all that stuff. And it was definitely embarrassing. It was definitely made him a laughing stock. But his other decisions as governor, he had always been pretty darn popular. And he had taken on a state legislature that had more than a few Republicans in it who were very comfortable with the way the state had been running, not interested in what we might call true conservative economic reform and things like that. Very comfortable bringing home pork to their home districts at the state level, that sort of thing. So even though there was a great deal of frustration with him and his, you know, egregious decisions in his personal life, there'd always been kind of it was interesting that he was not forced from office. He was not forced to resign. Some of that was due to having a phenomenally unpopular lieutenant governor, Andre Bauer. But when he left office, he actually had a fairly high approval rating. People really did kind of see him as a pretty good governor with this one, you know, I think somewhere in a South Carolina newspaper, my father is quoted as saying, as long as you get beyond one trip to Argentina, he's been a pretty good governor, which I think is an accurate summary of how most South Carolina Republicans felt about him, that he wasn't running for re-election. This was relatively late in his second term. Now, is this enough to get him elected to the House down in the 7th District of South Carolina? I'm not quite so sure. It's worth noting that Jenny Sanford, who was mentioned as a possibility for the Senate appointment, also lives in the district and is going to be – so. You think you've seen negative primaries before. You know, you thought negative South Carolina politics. picture Jenny Sanford versus Mark Sanford in a, as well as several other state lawmakers. I kind of be surprised if either Sanford ran, but look, I mean, pretty clearly Mark Sanford wants to get back into the game at some level, and maybe something, a quiet, diligent career in Congress might be a good way to return to the public stage in a way that will, you know, not put too much spotlight on his egregious decisions of the past. I do wonder if he does end up getting elected to the House, Greg, whether he will serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee. And you know, serve in Latin, because don't U.S. and Argentinian relations require someone of his leadership and stature?
I'm sure he'll volunteer to lead that subcommittee and a lot of congressional delegations. So, yes. Yeah, I believe he married her. At least he's engaged to her or something like that, the mistress down there now. So we'll see how all that plays out. But something tells me he's probably not going to end up holding that seat. Very quick champagne toast here. In addition to our three martinis today, as most of our listeners probably know, yesterday, longtime Hawaii Senator Daniel Inouye passed away after some respiratory complications. He was 88 years old, had represented Hawaii in either the House or the Senate for its entire history until today. A man with tremendous distinctions on the battlefield of World War II, Medal of Honor winner, lost an arm, fought at a time when obviously many people of his ethnicity were not treated well in this country. He then has been a rock for Hawaii, someone who has... Well, been a very liberal person, and I certainly am not going to endorse much of his voting record over the past half century. Someone who carried himself with dignity and someone that Hawaiians could look up to. So my condolences certainly to the Inouye family today.
I completely concur, Greg. Good to you to remember him. You know, we have a strong ideological view and partisan lens to things sometimes, but it is good to remember that even those who are on the other side have lives that before they ended up in Congress, although Inouye certainly did spend a lot of time in Congress. I'd seen that this is the first day, today is the first day Hawaii has not had, the state of Hawaii has not had Inouye as a senator, meaning that from the moment they became a state to today, there's always been that senator there. Whatever you think of his voting record and what he did in Congress, this was still a man of great courage in World War II, and it's good to salute those in passing for all that they do, not just their years in public life and lawmaking and things like that.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Wednesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.